Imagine looking at two identical businesses. I mean, they serve the exact same customers, they offer the exact same product, and they operate with, the exact same profit margins.
Right, identical in almost every functional way.
Exactly. Yet the market is currently pricing one at a rather massive discount while applying a heavy premium to the other. So today, we are doing a deep dive into Visa and MasterCard.
And we should clarify for the listener, we are not treating them as standard financial equities today. We are looking at a very specific structural question.
Yeah, drawing from a really rigorous article in the Averaging Up collection, the core question for you, the listener, is this. When two businesses share identical architecture, the exact same toll, the same moat, the same wave, and the same zero-cost growth.
How do you choose between them?
Right. And critically, why does the market price them so differently?
Well, that is the paradox we need to unpack. The Averaging Up collection categorizes these two companies not just as highly profitable, but as possessing the rarest business architecture on Earth.
The author refers to this specific structure as the free surfer.
Yes. And to dissect the market pricing, we first need to understand the mechanics of this free surfer structure. The article breaks it down into two operating forces, starting with the A, which is the toll.
And this toll is entirely infrastructural, right?
It is. It is just a fraction of a percentage taken from virtually every electronic transaction globally. That generates immediate short-duration cash for the business today.
And because no single entity can just, decree a secondary global payment network into existence overnight, that toll is highly protected.
Exactly. It has an insurmountable network effect connecting thousands of banks with millions of merchants.
Which brings us to the second force, the B. The author calls this the wave.
Right. So if the toll is the cash generated today, the wave represents the structural growth compounding that toll over time.
We are talking about the secular, decades-long migration from paper cash to digital payments. I mean, in many emerging markets, over 80% of daily transactions are still conducted in physical cash.
And that structural migration provides decades of runway. But what elevates this from just a strong business to a true free surfer is how the toll and the waves interact.
Because in a standard industrial business, capturing a new market requires heavy capital investment.
Precisely. If an automaker wants to sell 10% more vehicles, they have to buy steel, build new factories, hire additional labor. That growth requires immense effort and carries a persistent risk of capital destruction.
But for Visa and MasterCard, the cost of that B, the cost of riding that wave, is zero.
Yes, zero. As consumers in emerging markets transition from paper bills to debit cards, neither network has to spend a single dollar of capital expenditure to facilitate that specific behavioral shift.
They are essentially just processing electrons, so the revenue grows, but the underlying costs remain effectively static.
Which naturally produces mechanical margin expansion.
Yeah.
And the institutional metrics confirm that these two entities are identical twins. I mean, both operate with profit margins exceeding 60%.
And both convert approximately 50% of every dollar of revenue directly into free cash flow.
Right. That conversion rate is practically unmatched in public markets. The numbers reflect the underlying reality that they are the exact same business, just duplicated.
Which brings us right to the core mystery of this deep dive. If the architecture is identical and the metrics are identical, the valuation should logically mirror that reality.
But it does not. Instead, we see a massive divergence.
Visa is currently trading at approximately $326. That price is 21% below its zero growth floor.
While MasterCard is trading at approximately $492, which is 17% above its zero growth floor.
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to clearly define that zero growth floor for the listener because it serves as the ultimate valuation anchor.
It does. The floor represents the current free cash flow of the business, valued as a perpetuity. It is discounted back to the present at the risk-free rate, under the strict assumption that the business never grows another single dollar.
So, putting that in plain English, we are taking the guaranteed minimum cash they produce today, and we are putting a definitive price tag on it.
Assuming the business never innovates, never expands, never grows again,
Yes.
it acts as the absolute mathematical minimum the business is worth.
Meaning anything above that floor is future growth the investor is actively paying for, and anything below it is future growth the investor receives entirely for free.
Exactly. So we have a 38-point valuation spread between identical twins. An investor can buy Visa at a steep discount to its absolute floor, receiving all future growth for free, or pay a substantial premium above the floor for MasterCard.
And if we operate under the assumption that the market consists of highly educated institutional investors analyzing the exact same data, there has to be an invisible weight being placed on MasterCard to justify that premium.
There is. The author of the Averaging Up article identifies three specific forces driving this valuation divergence. The first is what we might call the illusion of permanent growth.
Right, because MasterCard is currently growing its revenue at approximately 17%, while Visa is growing at approximately 10%.
And the market observes this differential and willingly pays a premium for the higher rate.
But the article highlights a critical insight here. This differential is highly phase dependent. I mean, MasterCard is growing faster primarily because it is physically smaller.
Precisely. Visa processes roughly $4.3 trillion in gross dollar volume. MasterCard processes about $2.6 trillion.
So with a smaller base, MasterCard simply has more immediate mathematical room to capture cross-border transactions and gain share in those emerging markets we mentioned.
Right. And well, what is fascinating here is the nature of the environment they operate in.
Mm-hmm.
The article defines this as a cooperative duopoly.
It is not a zero-sum price war.
No, not at all. Neither network aggressively undercuts the other on interchange fees to steal market share. They just do not need to.
Because they are riding the exact same wave of global digitization, and the total pie is expanding rapidly enough to satisfy both of them?
Exactly. And what the market is doing is betting that the smaller entity will maintain that rapid growth rate indefinitely. They are completely ignoring the structural limitations of scale.
That actually brings up an analogy I was thinking about. It is like comparing this to two identical reservoirs filling with rainwater from the exact same storm.
That is a good way to frame it.
Yeah, one reservoir is significantly larger than the other. Because the smaller reservoir has less water in it initially, the rising water level appears much faster when you calculate it as a percentage.
Right, the percentage change is higher.
So the market looks at the smaller reservoir, sees a 17% fill rate, and prices that current rate as a permanent structural advantage.
And that reservoir analogy captures the flaw in the market's reasoning perfectly. The rainwater represents nominal GDP growth plus the global cash to digital migration.
Since they operate in a cooperative duopoly and collect rainwater from the identical storm, their growth rates are mathematically destined to converge.
Exactly. As MasterCard approaches Visa's scale, the law of large numbers dictates that its growth rate must decelerate to match Visa's.
So the growth differential is entirely a function of phase, not architecture. Yet the market prices the temporary rate as a permanent fixture.
Which means if organic growth is destined to converge, there must be another mechanism inflating MasterCard's performance metrics to sustain that narrative.
And this points us directly to the balance sheet, which is the second force driving the valuation spread, the leverage mirage.
The discrepancy in their capital structure is substantial. MasterCard operates with a debt-to-capital ratio of approximately 74%.
While Visa operates at a highly conservative 35%.
Right. And this fundamental difference in leverage introduces a significant distortion in how the returns are perceived.
So let me make sure I'm following the mechanics of this mirage. MasterCard essentially borrows capital at a relatively low rate, historically around 4%.
Yes.
And it then takes that borrowed money and deploys it into massive share buyback programs.
Precisely. Because the underlying business is a free surfer, compounding at 15% or more organically, that arbitrage is highly profitable on a spreadsheet.
I see.
By aggressively shrinking the outstanding share count using borrowed money, MasterCard accelerates its earnings per share far beyond its actual organic operational growth.
So a significant portion of that 17% growth rate the market is rewarding is not just operational excellence. It is leverage actively amplifying the return.
Yes. And Visa's 10% growth is fundamentally cleaner because it is far less amplified by debt. It is a much truer reflection of the underlying organic rate.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because this leverage introduces a crucial mathematical paradox that directly impacts the valuation floor we discussed earlier.
It does. The debt load actively compresses MasterCard's zero growth floor.
Right. Let us walk through the math on that compression for the listener. The zero growth floor is calculated based on free cash flow. So if MasterCard is carrying all this debt, they have to pay mandatory interest to service it. Interest eats directly into cash flow. Does that mean their actual baseline floor is shrinking while they engineer these buybacks?
That is exactly what it means. Higher interest payments mean less free cash flow is ultimately available to the equity owner, and less free cash flow means a mathematically lower valuation floor.
So if MasterCard carried Visa's lighter 35% debt profile, its free cash flow would be materially higher.
Yes, and consequently, its zero growth floor might be over $500.
Which means the current $492 market price might actually sit below an adjusted unlevered floor.
Right. The premium the market perceives is partially an artifact of the debt artificially compressing the baseline. But leverage is not just a mathematical tool used for financial engineering.
It is a direct introduction of risk. I mean, debt demands mandatory service regardless of the macroeconomic environment.
And we saw the consequences of this during the initial phases of the global pandemic. Cross-border travel halted, transaction volumes plummeted, and free cash flow dipped for both networks simultaneously.
But in moments of systemic stress, the balance sheet dictates the outcome.
Exactly. Visa's conservative leverage allows it to absorb macroeconomic shocks effortlessly, while heavily levered entities face immediate pressure.
Because the underlying thesis of the averaging up framework is that profound wealth generation requires compounding over a 20-year horizon.
And to compound capital over two decades, a business must survive every single economic cycle, recession, and shock along the way.
Carrying 74% debt mathematically reduces the certainty of that survival compared to 35%.
But we have established that MasterCard benefits from a phase-dependent growth narrative and inflates its metrics through leverage.
But Visa faces active headwinds that MasterCard largely escapes, which brings us to the third force driving the spread, regulatory asymmetry.
Visa operates with a level of regulatory friction that is disproportionately high compared to its twin.
Right. The U.S. Department of Justice frequently pursues antitrust actions specifically targeting Visa's debit network operations. And when merchants file massive class action litigation regarding interchange fees, Visa is inevitably the primary target.
Not to mention when regulatory bodies in Europe and Asia mandate strict caps on interchange rates, the sheer volume of Visa's routing means it absorbs the heaviest impact.
And MasterCard benefits simply by being the challenger in this scenario.
Yes. Being the smaller entity makes it inherently less politically visible to regulators. They operate the exact same duopoly, exacting the exact same toll, but they possess entirely different political profiles.
However, the averaging up framework requires us to separate market sentiment from structural reality. The regulatory headlines undeniably depress Visa's stock sentiment.
But if we analyze the history of these interventions, the structural damage has been highly manageable.
We can look at how they adapted to the Durbin Amendment in the United States, which strictly capped debit interchange fees for large banks.
Right. The Durbin Amendment was designed to pressure the networks and lower costs for merchants. But Visa's sheer scale allowed them to offer volume discounts to merchants, preserving their routing share despite the caps.
They adapted to that legislation just as they adapted to sweeping regulatory caps across the European Union.
They adapted because the infrastructural nature of the toll is permanent. A regulatory body can compress the margin slightly, but they cannot invent a new, fully functional global payment network to replace the free surfer.
So the regulatory headwind dictates a daily news cycle and suppresses the valuation multiple, but it does not alter the fundamental architecture of the business.
Exactly. So we have thoroughly deconstructed the three forces, creating this 38-point spread. We have a growth narrative that flatters the smaller twin, a leverage mirage that inflates its metrics while paradoxically compressing its floor, and a regulatory asymmetry that depresses the larger twin's market sentiment.
So if you are listening and looking at your portfolio right now, the vital question you have to ask yourself is what you actually receive when deploying capital at these vastly different prices.
And the Averaging Up article synthesizes this into a core framework, detailing three distinct layers of return available when purchasing a free surfer.
We must evaluate Visa and MasterCard against these three layers. Let us start with the first.
The first layer of return is the gap. This represents Benjamin Graham's classic margin of safety. When the market is irrational enough to price a dominant business below its zero growth floor, the mathematical distance between the price and the floor is the gap.
It provides pure structural protection.
Yes. If you buy below the floor, you are protected against disappointment. Even if the expected growth never materializes, the underlying cash flow generation ensures the investor earns a return superior to a risk-free treasury bond.
The second layer is the gift. This is Warren Buffett's concept of the ever-increasing equity coupon.
Right, because the zero growth floor assumes the business never grows another dollar. Any growth that does occur is entirely unpriced.
And with a free surfer, where the cost of the wave is zero, that 10 to 15% organic growth is delivered without capital expenditure.
It is a pure gift to the investor, meaning the yield on your original purchase price expands exponentially over time.
Which leads to the final layer, the guarantee. This is Charlie Munger's principle of convergence.
Yes. Over a long enough timeline, the return on a stock must mathematically converge with the return the underlying business earns on its own capital.
If the architecture is permanent and the entry price is rational, convergence is near certain.
And that convergence is advanced quarterly by dividends, but it is brutally forced by share buybacks. By constantly retiring shares, the company mechanically increases the per-share value, forcing the stock price upward to meet intrinsic value.
So, what does this all mean? Because I want to challenge that specific mechanism for a moment. Both Visa and MasterCard execute massive share buyback programs to force that convergence. If the mechanical action is identical, does the source of the capital funding those buybacks truly matter to the long-term investor?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the purity of the funding is absolutely paramount. Visa funds its massive share reductions almost entirely through clean, sustainable operating cash flow.
It generates the cash organically from its toll, and it returns it.
Exactly. MasterCard, operating at 74% leverage, relies heavily on debt issuance to fund a significant portion of its buybacks.
Which functions perfectly while interest rates are at 2 or 3%.
Right. It remains accretive only as long as cheap, abundant financing is accessible in the credit markets. The mechanism of shrinking the share count is the same, but the foundation supporting that mechanism is entirely different.
Visa's method is self-sustaining in any macroeconomic environment. MasterCard's method is tethered to the goodwill of the credit markets.
Which is a profound structural difference.
Let us run the mathematics on the break-even for this scenario. For an investor purchasing MasterCard at 17% above its floor, the averaging up analysis reveals a stark requirement.
It does.
To mathematically justify that premium and eventually outperform the investor who bought Visa below the floor, MasterCard must sustain approximately 13% growth for 20 consecutive years.
And we must weigh that requirement against the reality of the cooperative duopoly. We have established that growth rates in this specific architecture inevitably converge as the smaller entity scales.
Sustaining a 13% advantage over your identical twin for two continuous decades is a highly improbable bet against structural gravity.
If MasterCard drops below that 13% threshold at any point in the next 20 years, Visa's initial valuation gap dominates the final outcome.
That is a very sobering realization when laid out mathematically. It brings us to the conclusion of the averaging up framework.
The author concludes the analysis by revisiting a core principle from Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. They noted that they always knew they were going to become extremely wealthy. They just were not in a hurry.
Purchasing Visa at 21% below its absolute floor is the embodiment of not being in a hurry.
The framework definitively chooses the gap.
Buying Visa provides Graham's margin of safety to protect the downside. It provides Buffett's compounding gift of zero-cost growth. And it provides Munger's guarantee of convergence, funded by clean cash flow rather than debt.
The investor who buys MasterCard is not necessarily making an error. MasterCard remains a fundamentally exceptional free surfer. A satisfactory result is highly likely over time.
But that investor requires the growth narrative to persist perfectly, the leverage to remain continuously accretive, and they are ultimately in far much more of a hurry.
Same toll, same wave, different price. The entire thesis is that the price is the opportunity, and patience is the precise mechanism for collecting it.
Because when the underlying physical architecture of two systems is indistinguishable, the rational observer must trust the mathematics of the valuation floor, not the sentiment of the daily narrative.
The fundamental math of free cash flow and convergence eventually reasserts itself as an unbreakable law.
Which leaves us with one final structural question for you to consider as we close this deep dive. We've defined the toll as an infrastructural certainty today. But if both of these titans rely on that centralized payment rail, what happens when blockchain technologies or mature central bank digital currencies reach global scale?
That is the real unknown.
Could a completely new decentralized technological rail bypass this entrenched duopoly entirely, rendering the zero growth floor calculations obsolete for both twins? That is a variable the market is only just beginning to model. For those of you looking to explore more rigorous frameworks and detailed financial analysis of these models, we highly encourage you to visit the Averaging Up collection at averagingup.com.